You're in tune to KZSU Stanford. It's time for another edition of Raising Sand.
Pardon me, boy. Is that the Chattanooga choo-choo?
Yes, yes. Track 29.
Boy, you can give me a shine.
Can you afford to board Chattanooga choo-choo?
I got my fare.
And just a trifle to spare.
You leave the Pennsylvania station about a quarter to four. Read the magazine and then you're in Baltimore.
Dinner in the diner, nothing could be finer
than to have your ham and eggs in Carolina.
When you hear the whistle blowing eight to the bar, then you know that Tennessee is not very far.
Shovel all the coal in, gotta keep it rolling.
Woo woo, Chattanooga, there you are.
Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallium, with Glenn Miller and Chattanooga Choo Choo. This past week, we've seen renewed enthusiasm about high-speed rail, with President Obama's record $8 billion investment in high-speed rail added at the last minute to the new economic stimulus package. According to transportation experts, that money will not be enough to pay for a single bullet train, and by the time the $8 billion gets divided among the 11 regions across the country that the government has designated as high-speed rail corridors, these experts add that the money is unlikely to do much beyond paying for long-delayed improvements to passenger lines and making modest investments in California's plan for a true bullet train. With me today is David Schönbrunn, Executive Director of Transportation Solutions Defense and Education Fund, known as TransDEF. This is a nonprofit environmental organization created by transit activists to advocate for better solutions to transportation, land use, and air quality problems in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Welcome, David.
Nice to be here.
Well, it's great to have you because you are a transit activist. What is a transit activist as opposed to, for example, an expert that I quoted above?
A transit activist is someone who recognizes that to have a sustainable world, we need a great transit system. And so we tend to look at what's needed in terms of projects or what's needed in terms of making the system run better. And we want to get the transit operator to do whatever it's going to take to work better. So, for instance, Muni, there was Proposition E that was passed, which gave Muni a set of demands and a set of performance standards. And happily, Muni has greatly improved since then.
And let's define as we go, because our show is actually played around the world in a lot of different places. So Muni is the Municipal
Railway of San Francisco.
And it's an electrical run system.
No, it has buses, it has electrically powered trolleys, it has light rail trains, and it has cable cars. So it has just about every form of transportation you can imagine.
And it serves the San Francisco city, the city of San Francisco, and then just the areas right outside the city also.
No, it's just the city.
Okay. You are predominantly working with the San Francisco region, or is it California in general?
It's mostly the San Francisco Bay Area, but we're also active in several statewide processes having to do with climate change. And so along those lines, in California, transportation and motor vehicles are the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions. And so dealing with transportation is absolutely central to a successful response to the challenges of climate change.
And let's just back up for 1 minute, because I believe I came here in the late 70s, but I believe prior to the BART system, for example, and prior to the bridges, there was a pretty good system called the Key system.
Well, the Key system was a trolley system that ran in Alameda County, and I think it also went into part of Contra Costa. And it went over the Bay Bridge and served the Transbay Terminal in San Francisco.
And that disappeared because?
A combination of factors, one of which was that the country went auto crazy. There were giant amounts of money spent to promote automobiles. And there were billions of dollars spent to build an interstate highway system and to encourage the suburbanization of America, which we, by the way, believe had a lot to do with white flight from the cities. There was a definite racial aspect to that whole period of time. But it resulted in the destruction of trolley systems all over the country, including the Key system, and replacing them with buses built by General Motors. General Motors was central to the destruction of these trolleys.
And so what we're really looking at here is a very integrated system whereby one transportation system is pushed to the side, another one rises up, we begin to have all of these climate problems, we begin to have all of these pollution problems, we begin to have all of these social problems.
And congestion problems.
And congestion problems. And now it seems as though we're going to have to recognize the mistakes we made back then and come back to a different kind of a transportation system.
Well, actually, what we really need is more of what we used to have. Humans, for many thousands of years, did transportation by proximity so that they achieved their daily needs by walking to the store, walking to the marketplace, walking to their fields. And so it was only the advent of fossil fuels that enabled a lot of travel. So this is fundamentally unsustainable, certainly in the form that people do it now. So the whole practice of suburbanization was a dead end. It didn't work. It stopped working maybe 10, 20 years ago in terms of people being able to conveniently get around. So the idea that you can live far out in the country, jump in your car and go wherever you want to go, it just isn't possible anymore.
But it's hard to get that point across because a lot of people, I think, are still commuting, say, 20, 30, 40 miles a day, because it seems so ordinary to them. That's what they've been doing all their working lives.
Understood. So what happened is essentially our country made a disastrous wrong-way turn back in the 50s, and we've now reached the end of that period.
And is it, as a transit activist, is it difficult to get that point across, or are people coming to realize
people
that?
Don't want to hear it. I mean, let's be clear. There are trillions of dollars invested in the status quo, and we are in really serious trouble right now in terms of climate change, because the whole notion of getting in your car and driving by yourself to some far-off job, it's just not going to be happening for long. Because of climate change, we're going to need to seriously cut back how much driving people do. And that means we're going to need to change how people travel, and also eventually where they live. And so this points to really intense changes in our whole way of life. And this is not a subject that is comfortable for people to talk about. It scares them for good reason. It's different.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, it is the same as how people used to live. So what we think of in the future, we're expecting more like transit villages where people live reasonably close together, maybe over several stories over shops, and so they can walk to stores, to cafes, to restaurants, and to offices, or get on some kind of a transit system, either a train or a bus, and get to another cluster of development, and that these are interspersed between open space. So that's the future that we see as being needed.
Well, isn't that similar to, for example, some of the industries in the interior of the country, where there are, you'll hear of the...
You're talking about a company town?
Yeah, company town, exactly.
No, because... Different? Because we're talking about mixed use and diversity. So it's not just a single company. It's not one activity. It's people, this is where they live their lives. And And San Francisco is already that way in many ways.
In some areas it is, yeah.
For sure, and yeah. It's really a model. And there are other areas that are neighborhoods that have a lot of people, that have great transit, that have a lot of services, a lot of neighborhood-serving services. To me, that's what the future is.
And so this is what TransDef, these are the ideas that TransDef is trying to get out there.
Yes, and I'm happy to say that we've been advocating these ideas since the mid-90s. And we've had some degree of success in that the regional agencies for the San Francisco Bay Area have now adopted policies that strongly support the idea of more compact development. And so they have a whole program underway called FOCUS, which is all about having the next increments of growth be in places that already have good transit. So it's attempting, instead of the previous practice of developers buying up raw land in some far-flung area and making subdivisions, we're talking about thinking about where the development best should go. And also, the Bay Area is in the process of developing what's known as indirect source mitigation fees, where projects that generate a lot of auto trips, let's say new subdivisions, would pay fees that would mitigate those impacts.
So that's over and above their property taxes?
Absolutely.
And what kind of fees are we talking about?
We don't know yet. It's just starting to be discussed. But this is the future that we see happening, and the state has adopted some very important laws about climate change. AB 32 is the primary climate change law that sets goals of tremendously reducing our greenhouse gas emissions by 2050 and reducing them to 1990 levels by 2020, if I'm remembering correctly. So this means a lot of change.
Well, let's talk a little bit about these plans for the future. I know that on your website, for example, you have a plan called the 2035 Transportation Plan.
Well, that's not our plan. What's going on is the agency that handles finance for transportation in the Bay Area, they're known as the Metropolitan Transportation Commission, or MTC. Every now 4 years, they are required by federal law to adopt a regional transportation plan. They are about to do that next month. While the plan talks a lot about climate change, quite frankly, the projects that are in the plan are the same projects that they've always pushed, which is widening highways and doing BART extensions. And so in our view, this plan is completely inadequate in terms of pointing us in the direction that we need to be for the future.
Well, I opened up the show with this quote about the high-speed rail, and you just mentioned the BART extensions. What's the difference between the two?
Okay. BART extensions are, BART is a very strange hybrid of transportation modes.
Let me for our other listeners, BART, Bay Area Rapid Rapid Transit.
BART was the first modern transit system built in America after the death of the trolleys in the 40s. And so it was considered new and revolutionary at the time, but we believe that they got it wrong. It's a bizarre hybrid of a subway and a commuter rail system. Subways are incredibly expensive, and they're underground for very dense areas. The problem with BART that we see is that it travels to areas that have no density and does so in extremely expensive projects in terms of hundreds of millions of dollars per mile. So this is completely unjustified, and what it means is that our region has been spending billions of dollars doing stupid things with these BART extensions. Now, we're very strong advocates for high-speed rail, But we believe that the Bay Area and MTC have totally gotten it wrong in terms of how high-speed rail should be functioning in this region. And in fact, my organization has joined with a series of other transit advocacy organizations and two cities to sue the High-Speed Rail Authority to challenge their environmental impact report that they've just certified, which designs a route to access the Bay Area from the Central Valley, which is the central core of California.
The Central Valley would be...
All the way from Sacramento down to Bakersfield is the Central Valley. And so what MTC first did and then the High-Speed Rail Authority did is said that high-speed rail should access the Bay Area through Gilroy and points south and then head up into San Jose. And we're convinced that this is purely a method of encouraging sprawl in the area east of Gilroy in Merced County, and that it would be both faster, cheaper, more economical to operate, and less environmentally destructive to provide access to the Bay Area along the Altamont Corridor or the I-580 corridor. And so that's why we sued. We believe that the High-Speed Rail Authority had a predetermined conclusion of their analysis, and that they weren't willing to do an honest and fair comparison.
Before we go on to talking more about that, can you describe who actually owns these? Are they owned by the federal government? Are they owned by the state of California?
No. These are all public entities.
They are?
That are divisions of the state, ultimately. But they are independent-run agencies.
But your organization and these other organizations you were talking about are trying to influence...
We're nonprofits. These are public agencies. We sue public agencies.
And so how do you sue them? It takes a lot to sue a public organization. How do you do that?
We raise funds, and we get hire lawyers, and I work with the lawyers to develop our briefing materials. And we go in, and we often win, and then on appeal, we've found that we've gotten overturned a fair amount of times because of appointments that were made to the Federal Court of Appeals by the Bush administration.
Talk about one case that you won and then was later appealed.
We won a case that in which the judge agreed that MTC had failed to live up to a commitment it made to increase transit ridership throughout the Bay Area by 15% over 1982 levels. So at the time that we sued, the Bay Area's population had grown by 30%, and the transit ridership still hadn't had a 15% increase. And we said, this is because MTC has wasted its money on BART extensions and not actually done anything that really increased transit ridership. The judge agreed with us. We won a $1.1 million attorney's fee award, and then this was overturned at the Court of Appeals.
Based on?
A Republican judge who basically said that citizens shouldn't be able to sue, which goes totally against the actual Clean Air Act, which has a citizen suit provision in it. So this was purely political posturing by people with robes, and it was outrageous.
But at the same time, I mean, it seems as though BART has become a lot more popular. I've been taking BART for 15 years. It's nice that it's got an extension now to the airport. It made no sense that it had no extension to the...
Well, quite frankly, we fought that bitterly at the time, and we had a much better idea for the same money that... For the $1.5 billion that got spent on that project, we could have electrified Caltrain up and down the San Francisco Peninsula, brought it to downtown to the Transbay Terminal, to a new regional terminal, and it would have been a faster trip from the airport and cheaper trip. So that project has had extremely disappointing ridership. And again, the cost bears no relationship whatsoever to the meager benefits that were accomplished. So this was a classic example of Bay Area pork, in which some politician decided that he would make a name for himself by making this happen, carrying the ball, and then getting everybody else to agree with him. They then pulled together an enormous amount of money and spent it on this project, when in fact there were other higher priorities that nobody bothered dealing with because there weren't agencies in place with the responsibility. So if I may go into the history of this slightly, we're now seeing in the Bay Area the proposal for a BART extension from Fremont to San Jose, which is the largest city in the Bay Area, although it's a tremendously sprawled city. To which our comment is, well, hello, this should have had a rail connection back in the, you know, two decades ago. And had the region's priorities been straight, it would have. However, there was no agency whose jurisdiction covered connecting Alameda County to Santa Clara County, and so it didn't get done. And MTC had no interest in recognizing that there was a need there. So again, this was a very dysfunctional set of agencies.
It sounds like there's a core problem here, which is that there is no real vision that continues through different administrations, or there's a sense that I'm getting that there's either not a public...
What there is is pork. There's an absence of vision. I completely agree with that. And frankly, that's what we've been attempting to do. As advocates, we've been trying to give them a vision. And so, for example, after we won one of our cases, we settled with MTC, and they agreed to run the transportation plan that we designed. And so in 2005, they adopted an environmental impact report that had our plan in it. And that plan used all of the principles that we think are essential for the future, namely, stop widening highways, stop extending BART, put in conventional gauge rail, which is much cheaper. BART is a unique gauge, and so everything for it is custom built, which makes the cost just go out of sight. We wanted to see high-speed rail over the Altamont Pass. We wanted to see commuter rail in various locations, a lot of rapid bus services. And we also wanted to see higher costs for driving alone, and also encourage development around transit stations. So we put all those things together, and our alternative performed quite well. And so we have a vision, we have a strategy, we have an idea. It makes sense in relation to climate change. And the big fight is that MTC wants to go with what it's committed to in the past, which are, frankly, stupid projects that will waste enormous amounts of money. And that's the problem that we have with them. They really don't care.
They don't care, or they're just not educated?
They really don't care. The deals get cut, and that's it. End of story. And we're saying you can do better. They say we're not going to go look back. We threatened to sue them on that issue, and that's, you know, currently in contemplation.
I'm sort of sitting here in awe, because what I'm thinking is, here is a citizens group essentially, it's raising funds and is actually suing a bureaucracy that feels as though it's totally stuck in old way of thinking. It's also
the it that you just said, and it's crucial we understand who's the it. We think the bureaucracy is totally stuck. They think they are not subject to any constraints, that they talk only to God. And we showed them that, in fact, they're subject to judges. And we had one court that held up $9 billion of their funds at one point. So they knew that, in fact, they didn't have the degree of infinite power that they thought they had.
But what's in it for them to remain stuck this way? Because
it works.
It works now. It works for them.
That's all that counts. These are not long-term thinkers, okay? We have a transportation plan going out to 2035, but one of the unpleasant realities about MTC is that they do these long-range plans, but don't care what the environment looks like at the end of that plan. We would see them do these environmental impact reports, and it would say that this is a disaster. Would they do anything to change that? No, because they had cut their deals. So that's why we felt we had to sue them. They've started changing to some degree. They've gained an interest in smart growth land use, which is mixed-use development and pedestrian-friendly development around transit stations. So that has become a recognized part of their policies. But in terms of having cost-effective projects, that has never been an issue for these people. And so what that means is the most horrible projects come forward. And if the local people in the county want it, if the local officials want it, that's what gets adopted. And that's just not good enough anymore.
Let's talk about the election, November election. There was a couple of transportation issues on
yes.
in that election. Talk about those.
Well, my organization, we were very involved in that election because, on the one hand, in the county that I personally live in Marin and Sonoma counties, we had a measure on the ballot. Encouraging a commuter rail system for a 1/4% sales tax. And that won, that passed. I worked for 20 years to put that forward, feeling that it was absolutely crucial that people have an alternative to driving on the freeway if they're making a long distance trip in our corridor. Then the high speed rail bond was on the ballot, a $9.9 billion bond that we opposed. And not because we oppose high-speed rail, we very much support high-speed rail, but we don't trust the high-speed rail authority, the people that are actually making the decisions. And so these are the people we're suing.
And that one
passed 54%, which is amazing to me given that the economy was bad and that there was no campaign. So it said that the people in some way understand that this is a good thing. So that's actually good. But again, the people who are running it are untrustworthy, in my opinion. And then the last one was a 1/8% sales tax in Santa Clara County for raising funds for the BART extension. And we opposed that as well. And we, in fact, went to court after that election demanding a manual recount because that measure won by 0.1%. So it was extremely close. You can't get any closer than that. And our understanding of both the law and the statistics are that it was highly likely that, that nobody actually knew whether it won or not, that it was too close to call. Mm. It was less than one vote per precinct that made the difference. So that means, so that's why we wanted a manual recount, and we felt the law required that, and the Secretary of State and the Registrar of Voters conspired and prevented us from getting justice in that election.
Where does that stand now, then?
That's done.
But, I mean, at the same time, we're talking about spending more money, and the state of California is broke. So these things.
Well, and that's why it's one of the tenets of our organization that if we don't spend money wisely, we're in real trouble. We are facing a situation of peak oil where we fully expect oil prices to go out of sight. What we saw a year ago when oil hit or when gas hit $4 a gallon or more, we fully believe that that's the future, that what we're seeing globally is the production of oil is stagnant. They're not finding new massive amounts of oil in discoveries, mm-hmm. but on the other hand, consumption is increasing exponentially. So these two are going to have to come into tremendous conflict, at which point gas is going to be much more expensive than we're used to, and thinking about whether to drive or not will be a much more serious economic question. Given that, we need to provide convenient transit to make it possible for people to get around. And if we waste our money on the things that are in this current regional transportation plan, the public is going to be really screwed. Mm-hmm. That's where our concern comes from.
David, I want to talk more about the social aspects, but I want to first remind our listeners that this is Raising Sand Radio, KZSU Stanford, FM 90.1. Susan Gallimore talking with David Schonbrunn of TransDef, which is Transportation Solutions Defense and Education Fund. David, what I'm hearing is that we have some major changes to make in our heads about
yes.
how we're going to be living.
Yes.
And what I think you're trying to get at is let's have these things in place so that by the time we actually psychologically are able to deal with them, we have them. And that's...
Well, by the time we're forced to change, that we've built the infrastructure that we need to make it possible to do it without tremendous pain and suffering. Mm-hmm. That's the issue to me.
Because we're also talking about here in California, certainly in the Bay Area, we have farmers markets and people truck their stuff in. But a lot of our food comes from other countries, and that also puts the price of food up.
Sure.
So we have a lot of change, but some of it is about education, isn't it? Some of it is just about making it okay for people to understand that public transportation is kind of cool.
Well, the funny thing about all this is a lot of the transit advocates come from the East Coast. I grew up in New York, and I feel that I have a background in which I know from living that transit works. And when I lived in San Francisco for 5 years, I didn't have a car. I didn't need a car, and I didn't want a car. You can have a much lower impact lifestyle, and it can be convenient, but you have to design it. And so we are here in California, although I didn't come to California to do this. I came here because it's the promised land. It's where groovy things are happening. I was here during the 60s and, you know, very much fell in love with being here, and what I'm doing as a transit activist is trying to preserve the beautiful things, what makes this such a beautiful area. And what I see are that the inherent dynamics of highways are turning us into Los Angeles, that the same dynamics are playing here, and they don't belong here.
Mm-hmm.
So anyhow, as a result of being a person from the East, I know transit works, and that's why I can stand up and say, we need to do this. And people here who grew up here just don't have that experience. It's just alien to them. And frankly, this is where the future is.
I came here in 1977, and I remember Pinol barely existed. It was a very small, old Pinol. And since when you drive out that way now, it is just house after house after
sure.
house. And that's true in every suburb around here.
Yeah.
And
that's what I'm calling the Los Angeles aspect.
Exactly. And it takes hours on a bad day. If BART goes down, it takes hours to get to.
And the reality is when you have subdivisions like that where there's just housing, no mixed services right there so that you can walk to places. If you have to drive, that causes congestion. So suburbs cause congestion. And that point has not been adequately understood. There's an assumption that suburb equals how we live. Sorry, not that way.
Mm-hmm. Suburbs also mean isolation, though.
Yeah.
You're in your house. Some suburbs, nice suburbs in this area, don't have sidewalks.
Yeah.
Because the assumption is, why do you need a sidewalk? Nobody's
exactly.
going to use it.
Exactly. Exactly. Or we don't want them to use it, even worse. So, again, these, while understandable, these now are dysfunctional. Okay? And a lot of the subprime mortgage meltdown, my understanding is it's caused by people who live in these areas on the fringe of the Bay Area who were no longer able to afford paying for gas to commute to their jobs in their SUVs, and then lost their houses. So there's a very direct tie-in to where you live, what your mode of transportation is, and the affordability. And so it's my belief and my organization's belief and that of many other people that seriously faulty choices have been made, and there's going to be a cost to be paid.
And again, how do you educate people to... I think people are open to knowing new things, especially in a recession like this. But how do you get them to take those steps when they're already invested in an SUV or whatever the local, the transportation system is that they use that's usually gas-based?
I don't have good answers for that. You know, it would be good if I did, but the whole public relations aspect, my conclusion essentially is that we've got a product that nobody wants.
The product being the system.
The future... a sustainable future. My take is that people are not willing to look at this because it's too scary, and their elected leaders are certainly uninterested in looking at it. They're not going to get elected as a result of leading the charge for the future.
That's a very scary thing.
It's
a very scary thing.
It's totally scary. You know, I feel my role is to at least... be in front of these public agencies and tell them what I think, because they're not doing the job.
And they're not doing the job because they want to be elected and they don't care how they get elected, so they'll go with the old stuff, or they just don't have a clue about what the future needs to look like.
Could be either. I'm seeing the commissioners at MTC are getting a lot more educated. It's really... thrilling, you know, over the decades that I've been involved, the whole level of discussion has moved a lot. Mm. And this is good. But one of the giant problems here is the political cycle. The political cycle is 4 years. The problem cycle is 50 years. And the two just don't match. And so we don't have people who are willing to go out on a limb and say, look, this is not going to be comfortable, but we really have to do this. We need to be grown-ups. That's essentially my message, and it's not a sexy message. It's not an attractive message, and I have no idea what to do about that, only that I know it's true.
Well, are there any leaders that you're seeing that are in office now that are... beginning to step up
very,
to the plate?
Very interesting. I heard on yesterday's news, the new Secretary of Transportation said, we're going to need to start charging because...
Now we're talking about the state of California or
no,
the federal level?
On the federal level, the Secretary of Transportation said, and I don't have the complete story on this, I just got the headline, but he said that because gas taxes... are losing their revenue-generating ability because we have more efficient cars and blah, 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 that we're going to need to start to change our method of raising money to support our roads by charging for miles driven. And this is something we very much want to see. So this actually is exciting. One hopeful sign is that the new Federal Secretary of Transportation, who's a Republican, is saying that gas taxes, we've been losing revenue because cars are getting more efficient, and so we're not getting the same amount of gas tax revenue as we used to in relation to inflation and all that. And he said, he floated the idea that we should be charging for how many miles somebody drives. And as an environmentalist, very strongly support this. It's a, you know, it's desperately what's needed. So that is exciting. But I frankly don't think the Democrats are likely to have the guts to actually go with this. And so it's all about leadership. And somebody has to stand up, excuse me, and say, hey, we're in a really serious problem in terms of climate change. We drive too much. That's causing the biggest amount of greenhouse gases. We have to reduce the amount we're driving, and the most effective way of doing that is for driving to cost more so that we use it more judiciously.
The only thing I see with that is our whole way of thinking about who we are as Americans is jeopardized.
Therein lies the problem. That identity is now dysfunctional, okay? That identity no longer works, and the whole idea of the American dream is now obsolete in my view.
That's almost treasonous to say.
Hey, which is more important, reality or a belief system?
Okay? I agree with you, but a belief system is a very difficult thing to change.
I agree, and that's why the most likely thing that's going to happen is gas prices are going to go up to $7 and $10, and people are going to be extremely screwed, and then they're going to want to blame somebody.
Well, let's talk about gas prices then for a minute, because as you mentioned, they went way up in the last year of the Bush administration, and then they dropped down again before the election, and now they're back at a price where we're all looking at them going, oh, what a nice price for gas. But in fact, they have to go up again.
They have to. And there's...
Why did they go down? Do you think it was about the election?
I do. I can't prove it. And every time this issue has arisen, there's an investigation which never finds anything. It's all way too fishy for me. But the fact that the economy, the world economy, went down the toilet is relevant. And that definitely reduced the overall global demand. But it went far lower than makes any sense to me. So my understanding is that the oil companies are playing with it.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's open this up a little bit to include China now, because even let's say that we were able to pull ourselves together and do things that made more sense economically, socially, culturally, and everything that needs to happen for these transportation systems to get in place and do the job that someone like you is proposing. What about a country like China, where they're just on a jag right now, they're building cars, they're driving cars in ways that they never have before.
They want to make all the mistakes that Americans have made, mm-hmm. and you know, it's sad. In major cities, they have prohibited bicycles, which has got to be the most energy-efficient form of transportation, you know, going totally the wrong direction now.
And looking for oil in places.
Oh, that, for sure. And we're going to see global contest in terms of resources. This is clearly, you know, where the world is going, and the U.S. is spending hundreds of billions of dollars a year on the military. And if you look closely, you realize that this is eventually to fight China. They're certainly not, you know, gearing up to, you know, go after Cuba or whatever. So that's the only excuse for these tremendous military expenses. So
you realize that a lot of people don't think that way, and that's quite a radical statement to the ears of perhaps some listeners.
That what?
That we're going after militarily building up in order to deal with China.
Well,
in
fact, let me pose the question. What military threat currently exists that would cause the United States to spend more money than the entire rest of the world put together? There's no threat out like that unless you have some wild notion of eventual resource wars with China.
Or unless you are bought into a system that you feel you can't close down because it's such a money generator, which is the arms industry.
Yeah, but what's the justification? They, you know, even if, you know, I'll grant you, even if it's a giant scam, they at least have to have a plausible explanation for why these weapon systems are necessary. Okay?
It's called national security.
Yeah, but security for what threat?
What threat did we have 7 years ago?
Well, therein lies the problem. We didn't have a threat, and that's well known now. So yeah. I don't want to get too far off on this tangent, but suffice it to say, I'm not beholden to the majority narrative.
So Japan has, I think they have the most advanced high-speed rail systems.
Okay.
And the rail systems that we have in the United States, even though we, you know, are touting them as something unique in the United States, they're still slower. The ones that we're proposing building are still slower than the ones that they have in Europe and Japan.
Well, I think we need to make several distinctions here. The first is that the United States has essentially been out of the passenger rail industry and the passenger rail world since the 50s. And so while there are some viable rail transit systems like New York City, Chicago, San Francisco, there's a little one in Los Angeles, these are very modest on the scale of what's happening in the rest of the world. There is much greater dependence on transit and rail transit in Europe, for instance. And that's caused by having all these systems that are all tied together in a network so that you can actually get from one place to another. We just don't have anything like that because of this addiction to the automobile. That has destroyed our transit functioning. We used to have trolleys that would run from Sacramento, for example, to San Francisco. Amazing stuff.
That was in the 50s? When was...
Probably 40s ended. But, you know, there were trolley systems all over the country, and all of that got torn up. So we have a huge amount of work to be done. But that said, what is proposed for California would actually be a very decent system. The problem is, where are they going to bring it? And we have just filed our opening brief suing the California High-Speed Rail Authority, challenging their environmental impact report for the access from the Central Valley to the Bay Area. And part of what we're alleging in there is that before the authority was brought into existence, there was a predecessor agency called the High-Speed Rail Commission that studied the issues and came up with the opposite conclusions. And so essentially what's happened is that I believe these agencies are playing to the interests of real estate developers and real estate speculators, that's actually what is driving the route decisions. And it's scandalous. It's absolutely scandalous. And so we're doing what we can to overturn that and have the high-speed rail route go where the most people are, where it can provide the best service and make the biggest difference in getting people out of their cars onto trains and reducing our greenhouse gas emissions.
David Schonbrunn, it's been great to have you, and I'm going to tell our listeners to go to www.transdef.org, TRANSDEF.org, and I want to give you the opportunity to urge our listeners to a better way of living through transportation or whatever else you would like to end with.
I just want to invite people to take a look at our website to let you know what kind of transportation issues are present in the Bay Area today, and to let you know that it really matters where our money gets spent, that it will determine whether or not we have a decent and sustainable future.
That was David Schonbrunn, Executive Director of Transportation Solutions Defense and Education Fund, known as TransDef. Visit their website, www.transdef.org, that's TRANSDEF.org, and become part of the future of your community. Look at a few interesting things currently going on in our world. The 81st Annual Academy Awards is over, in the Rags to Riches feel-good movie Slumdog Millionaire, directed by Danny Boyle and Loveleen Tandon, original music by A.R. Rahman, and starring Dev Patel, garnished Oscars. Meanwhile, back in Mumbai, India, the actual real-life people living in Dharavi slum have been in the streets protesting the film. In one case, activists led slum-dweller protests with placards that read, "Don't call us dogs," and "I am not a slum dog." Claiming that referring to people in the slums as dogs has violated their human rights, they filed a lawsuit demanding the title of the movie be changed. Music director A.R. Rahman, actor Anil Kapoor, and other Indians associated with the film are accused of, quote-unquote, offending the sensibilities of slum dwellers with the abusive title of the movie. Danny Boyle, who is a British citizen, was not charged. The defamation case began February 18th and continues this week, February 24th. It's not just those living in slums reacting. Ellis Miles of the Times of London goes so far as to suggest that the film is an example of quote-unquote poverty porn, where the suffering of the Indian poor is served up as a perverse form of first world voyeurism. What do you think? Send us an email and express your views to susan@raisingsandradio.org. On a different note, the long-awaited UN-backed trial of former Khmer Rouge leaders in Cambodia has opened in Phnom Penh, 30 years after that regime fell. Pol Pot himself, of course, died in 1998. The first witness, Khaen Get Uv, better known as Doik, was head of a notorious prison camp and is accused of presiding over the murder and torture of at least 15,000 inmates. He is one of five former Khmer Rouge leaders who will face trial and is unusual in that he has expressed regret for what he did and asked the forgiveness of his victims. War reporter John Pilger is in Phnom Penh and he writes, "It is highly unlikely Pol Pot would have come to power had President Richard Nixon and his National Security Advisor, Henry Kissinger, not attacked neutral Cambodia. In 1973, B-52 bombers dropped more bombs on Cambodia's heartland than were dropped on Japan during the Second World War. It was equivalent to five Hiroshimas. Prior to the bombing, the Khmer Rouge had been a Maoist cult without a popular base. The bombing delivered a catalyst. What Nixon and Kissinger began, Pol Pot completed." Pilger continues, "Kissinger will not be in the dock in Phnom Penh. He is advising President Obama on geopolitics. Unless international justice is a farce, those who sided with Pol Pot's mass murderers ought to be summoned to the court in Phnom Penh. At the very least, their names should be read into infamy's register." So let's remember this and pressure President Obama to confront the excesses of our most recent administration and not to sweep those under the rug. Consider supporting Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Patrick Leahy as he pushes forward for a comprehensive investigation into the conduct of the Bush administration. Speaking at a forum in Georgetown University, the Vermont Democrat suggested the creation of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission to uncover the misdeeds, quote-unquote, of the past 8 years. Leahy said, "The president is right that we need to focus on fixing the problems that exist and improving the future for hardworking Americans. I wholeheartedly agree and expect the Judiciary Committee and the Senate to act accordingly. But that does not mean that we should abandon seeking ways to provide accountability for what has been a dangerous and disastrous diversion from American law and values. Many Americans feel we need to get to the bottom of what went wrong. We need to be able to read the page before we turn it." Give Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Patrick Leahy's office a call and let them know you support this investigation. The number is 202-224-4242. Again, 202-224-4242. We'll be a stronger nation for it. That's our show for this week. Views expressed are those of the host and guest and not KZSU or Stanford University. Join us again next week when we'll be speaking with members of the Collateral Repair Project in Amman, Jordan, to learn about the status of Iraqi refugees in that country.
what you say.
Step aside, partner, it's my day. Bend an ear and listen to my version
of a really solid Tennessee excursion.
Pardon me, boy, is that the Chattanooga choo-choo?
Yes, yes, rank 29.
Boy, you can give me a shine.
Can you afford to board Chattanooga choo-choo?
I got my fare
and just a trifle to spare.
You leave the Pennsylvania station about a quarter to four. Read the magazine and then you're in Baltimore.
Dinner in the diner, nothing could be finer
than to have your ham and eggs in Carolina.
When you hear the whistle blowing eight to the bar, then you know that Tennessee is not very far.
Shovel all the coal in, gotta keep it rolling.
Woo-woo, Chattanooga, there you are.
There's gonna be a certain party at the station.
Satin and lace.
I used to call Funny Face. She's gonna cry until I tell her that I'll never roll.
So Chattanooga choo-choo,
won't you choo-choo me home?
Chattanooga, Chattanooga,
all aboard.
Chattanooga, Chattanooga,
get aboard.
Chattanooga, Chattanooga.
Chattanooga choo-choo, won't you choo-choo me home?
Chattanooga choo-choo.